This is BYU News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Joe Biden led a national eulogy and candlelight vigil to mark the tragic milestone of more than 500,000 COVID deaths in the United States. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn.
A bell tolled at the National Cathedral before President Biden called the 500,000 deaths a grim, heartbreaking milestone.
As we acknowledge the scale of this mass death in America, remember each person and the life they lived.
He offered special condolences to those who are grieving.
My heart aches for you, those of you who are going through it right now.
And urged the nation to put the politics aside and honor the dead by stopping the spread of the virus.
Socially distance, to mask up. Get vaccinated when it's your turn.
Biden, the vice president, and their spouses bowed their heads for a moment of silence outside the White House as 500 candles flickered to reflect 500,000 lives lost. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Businesses and teachers reacted in England Monday to the new roadmap set out by the UK government to ease coronavirus restrictions. Earlier in the day, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson laid out a slow easing of one of Europe's strictest pandemic lockdowns, which will see children in England return to class and people able to meet a friend outside for coffee in 2 weeks' time. But those longing for a haircut, restaurant meal, or a pint in a pub have almost 2 months to wait. Shops and hairdressers will reopen on April 12th, along with pubs and restaurants, though customers will only be able to dine outdoors. Indoor venues such as theaters and cinemas and indoor seating in bars and restaurants are now scheduled to open May 17th. More at VOANews.com. This is VOA News. The investigation into an engine explosion on a jetliner taking off from Denver is focusing on a fan blade that appeared to be weakened by wear and tear. That's a development reminiscent of a fatal failure on board another plane in 2018. These and other recent engine failures raise questions over long-held assumptions about how long fan blades last and whether they're being inspected often enough. The Boeing 777, operated by United Airlines, had to make an emergency landing in Denver after one of its engines blew apart, spewing huge chunks of wreckage that landed in neighborhoods and sports fields. Passengers captured video of the crippled engine wobbling and still on fire as pilots made a safe return to the airport minutes after the plane bound for Hawaii took off. The wife of a Mexican drug kingpin is arrested on a U.S. drug charge or charges, AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
The wife of imprisoned Mexican drug lord Joaquin El Chapo Guzman was arrested at Dulles International Airport outside Washington Monday and charged with helping Guzman run his criminal empire. In a single count complaint, 31-year-old former beauty queen Emma Coronel Ispuro is charged with conspiracy to distribute cocaine, methamphetamine, heroin, and marijuana in the U.S. She's expected to appear in federal court in Washington Tuesday. Guzman, who was extradited to the United States in 2017, was tried, convicted, and sentenced to life behind bars in 2019. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, said Monday Iran could increase its level of uranium enrichment to whatever the country needs. He made the comments as a standoff between Iran and the United States continues over the future of the Iran nuclear deal. He said that Iran's uranium enrichment level will not be limited to 20%, adding that we will and may increase it to 60%. The U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price said Khamenei's comment sounds like a threat, he added, and we're not going to respond in specific hypotheticals. He said the United States will reaffirm the proposition on the table that the United States is willing to meet with the Iranians to hash out the specific questions. Under the 2015 nuclear agreement between Iran and six world powers, Iran is limited to refining uranium to 3.67%, but Iran has been in breach of the agreement and agreement since the United States withdrew from the pact during the Trump administration. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
We'll be right back. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 23rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Congolese and the world mourn the deaths of Italy's ambassador and two others.
When I heard it, the first reaction was, my God, how can this happen? Wasn't he escorted by heavy policemen from the local government in South Kivu province or security people from the national government here?
Somalia accuses UAE of fueling political unrest in Somalia over elections. Lesotho's government says it has met U.S. government demand to address alleged human trafficking problems. Sudan devalues its currency, and Uganda's Bobby Wine will withdraw his election petition from the Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court said we could only submit our petition for 30 minutes. So, for the reasons that we've given above, we have decided to withdraw from their court. The courts are not independent. It is clear that these people are working for Mr. Museveni.
Is Tanzania's president finally acknowledging COVID-19? And Malawi public school teachers are refusing to go back to school. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations has condemned the murder of the Italian ambassador to the Democratic Republic of Congo, his bodyguard, and a World Food Program driver. Ambassador Luca Attanasio and the two others were killed Monday in eastern Congo when unidentified gunmen fired on their convoy. The Deputy Special Representative of the UN Secretary General David Maclanka says those responsible for the attack must be identified and prosecuted. Noel Shiani is leader of the Forces of Change political grouping in the DRC and a former presidential candidate. He says Congolese, including President Felix Tshisekedi's government, are also shocked by the murders.
When I heard it, the first reaction was, my God, how can this happen? Wasn't he escorted by heavy policemen from the local government in South Kivu province? Or why wasn't he accompanied by security people from the national government here? But this evening, I saw on television the foreign minister of the Democratic Republic of the Congo addressing his condolences to the family of the ambassador, but also other people who were killed in this incident. And at the same time, explaining that as foreign minister, he was not informed that the ambassador was traveling to this dangerous area. I heard also that the local authorities in South Kivu province were not even aware of the presence of the ambassador in this dangerous area. It is very unfortunate. I would like to take this opportunity to address my sincere condolences to his family, to the families of all the people who are killed in this incident, and to call on the international community so that it can combine its efforts, its resources with the authorities of the Democratic Republic of the Congo to establish as soon as possible peace and stability in the east of the Congo. Because what we've just gone through with the death of this ambassador is just one of the many incidents which are happening there on a daily basis. The local people are killed every single day. It must stop.
We know that in that part of the country, the Hutu militia group called the FDLR are operating there even during the administration of former President Kabila. Has anyone claimed responsibility for the attack?
So far as I know, nobody has claimed the responsibility. From my own recollection, there are more than 250 militia groups operating in the east. So far, we don't know who has done this.
I guess the militias in the DRC, one of the challenges facing President Felix Tshisekedi, I wonder, is there any plan? Has the government announced any plan how to deal with these armed groups?
Well, as far as I know, President Tshisekedi has announced a number of initiatives, including, for example, himself going and settle in the east to be close to the area where the troubles are, to make sure that he gets all the information and he mobilizes the army, the police, and security to fight the heads-on the militia groups. That's one of the initiatives that he has taken. But also, he has announced that he was going to move the headquarters of the army and the police and place it in the east, close to the area where those problems are happening.
Thank you so much, Mr. Shiani, for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me on Voice of America.
Noel Shiani is leader of the Forces of Change political grouping in the DRC and a former presidential candidate. He was speaking with us from the capital, Kinshasa. Ugandan musician and opposition leader Robert Chakulai, known also as Bobby Wine, on Monday said he would withdraw his petition at the Supreme Court, challenging the January re-election of President Yoweri Museveni. Wine alleged bias in the court towards Museveni and said he was not being allowed to present evidence of fraud in the vote. Halima Athumani reports from Kampala.
In announcing his decision Monday, Wine said authorities had blocked his attempt to present a case, citing the police lockdown of his party offices and the military denying access to his lawyers and officials of his National Unity Platform Party. He also accused the Supreme Court of rejecting as many as 200 affidavits. Wine said this is a sign the judiciary does not intend to serve justice in the matter and they would not participate in what he called mockery to justice.
The Supreme Court said we could only submit in this our petition for 30 minutes. Now that was clear. One, the Supreme Court did not want this matter to attract so much attention. So for that matter, for the reasons that we've given above, we have decided to withdraw from their court. The courts are not independent. It is clear that these people are working for Mr. Museveni.
Through his lawyers, Wine filed the petition February 1st, seeking to nullify the election that saw President Museveni win a sixth term with 58% of the votes. They also asked the court to ensure that Museveni can never run again in an election, accusing him of orchestrating violence, using soldiers to pre-tick ballots and invade polling stations. Jameson Karemani, the court registrar, says the court is not bothered by Wine's allegations of favoritism. He says once the court receives the application to withdraw the petition, judges will decide on the matter, but it will be conditional.
Conditional in the sense that you filed a petition and served it on other parties. The parties had to go out of their way to prepare themselves for your petition. Now you have withdrawn it, they have incurred costs. So the condition may be for you to be asked to pay the costs.
Last week, President Museveni, the Electoral Commission, and the Attorney General filed a total of 185 affidavits in response to the 53 grounds raised by NUP lawyers. Oscar Kihika, Museveni's lawyer, says officials will wait for Wine's application.
He's made the announcement. We have heard it. What for us we do as the legal team on the other side is to wait for the application to be filed and served on us as is required by the law.
Wine says the matter will now be presented before what he calls the People's Court, meaning the Court of Public Opinion. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala.
Somalia has accused the United Arab Emirates of fueling a political standoff and opposition protest over elections that are threatening the country's stability. Mohamed Kaher reports on an opposition leader's briefing and talks to political analysts on the role of Gulf Arab states. In this report from Mogadishu.
The federal government of Somalia says the United Arab Emirates is to blame for a political instability in the wake of violent protests by opposition leaders last week. Authorities in Mogadishu were responding to an Emirati Foreign Ministry statement that described the government of President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo as an interim administration. Somali elections have been delayed by squabbles among political leaders as President's term officially expired on 8 February. Some opposition groups have called on Mohamed, who is commonly known as Farmajo, to step aside, but he has continued to carry out the duties of office. Information Minister Osman Dube demanded Abu Dhabi issue an apology. Dube said his country is recuperating from violence and does not want to take the path of conflict again. Therefore, calls upon the brotherly state of Emirates to apologize for the mistake. Emirati officials have not responded to the accusations. Somali opposition groups, through their chairman and presidential candidate Sheikh Sharif Sheikh Ahmed, said they will continue their demonstrations until transparent polls are conducted. Sharif said they will not give up their constitutional rights to conduct peaceful protests to strengthen democracy in the country. He called upon opposition supporters to attend a rally next Friday. Somalia and United Arab Emirates shared strong traditional historic ties, but relations cooled after Mogadishu took a neutral stance toward the Gulf country's 2017 blockade of Qatar instead of siding with United Arab Emirates. Political analyst Mohamed Salah says he believes that the decision by Farmajo government and confiscation of more than $9 million from Emirati officials at Mogadishu airport in April 2018 angered the Gulf nation.
The two countries' relations has been deteriorating for quite a while for two main reasons. Number one, the neutral role that Somalia is taking on the Gulf crisis did not go well with the United Arab Emirates. The second one, the way that United Arab Emirates deals with Somalia did not go well with the current administration, because United Arab Emirates has a strong relationship with the regional leaders and the current administration did not like that.
The international organizations such as the United Nations and the African Union have repeatedly urged Somali leaders to resolve their differences and move forward with elections without resorting to violence. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 23rd. Lesotho's government says it has met a U.S. government demand for Lesotho to address its alleged human trafficking problem. Home Affairs Minister Motlatletwa Lesosa says the government submitted a report on human trafficking to the U.S. Embassy in Maseru on February 12. But critics say the government is paying lip service to addressing the concerns raised by the U.S. government. U.S. Ambassador to Lesotho, Rebecca Gonzalez, had given the government a February 1st deadline to show that Lesotho is seriously addressing human trafficking concerns, or Lesotho will lose U.S. funding. Home Affairs Minister Lesosa says he hopes the report would help the U.S. make an informed decision.
We submitted our report to America. They recommended that we amend our Anti-Trafficking in Persons Act 2011. So we have effected that amendment. It is a law now, Anti-Trafficking in Persons Amendment Act 2021.
There were allegations that some senior officials, including the Deputy Prime Minister, had been implicated in this human trafficking. What did your investigation find?
So I had the request from the government of America are concerned. There was no such. But somebody, our political opponent in Lesotho, interviewed by the newspaper and then claiming that Deputy Prime Minister should go to the court of law to clear his name with regard to human trafficking. So everybody took it and thought it was a thing. And you can call the police, you can call whoever. We don't have a case that is dealing with Deputy Prime Minister being involved in human trafficking. Why? Because that was just a political talk, and it remains that.
Is your government open to the idea that the U.S. has said that you should not only investigate, but be willing to prosecute anyone that would be implicated? Are you open to prosecuting anyone implicated?
Very open. I think one thing you can be sure of is that I am leading that campaign to fight human trafficking as the Minister of Home Affairs. What I even did is to ask the police to come and look for any document at Home Affairs, any assistance from the Home Affairs officials, anything which they think can help them. They come to my ministry and my office requesting to interview certain officials in my department. I said, go on. So they asked them, they interviewed them, they came to ask for certain records, we gave them the records. And I kept saying, whatever you want, which you think can help you root out this problem, we are open, we are ready. So police are doing their way.
Mr. Minister, as you know, the U.S. government has put your country in Tier 3, which is the lowest ranking according to its Trafficking in Persons 2020 report. There are consequences that your country could lose development funding and also health, including even AGOA. So what are your expectations now that you have completed this report?
Well, I think Now that we have submitted the report, the U.S. government will be in a position to make informed decisions as to whether we still remain in Tier 3 or we move out of Tier 3, maybe into Tier 2 or something like that.
Minister, it's so nice to talk with you. I appreciate very much.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Molalentwa Letsosa is Lesotho's Home Affairs Minister. He was speaking with us from the capital, Maseru. Sudan's central bank on Sunday sharply devalued its currency, the Sudanese pound, in an effort to get debt relief, crack down on the black market, and attract money back to the country. Sudan's annual inflation is more than 300%, one of the world's highest, and sparked protests over the struggling economy. Naba Mohideen reports from Khartoum.
Sudan's central bank on Sunday sharply devalued its currency, the Sudanese pound, and unified the price with the black market at 370 pounds for one US dollar. The government says the decision aimed at attracting investments and controlling imports and exports. Khartoum-based economist Abu Bakr Omar welcomed the government's decision. Omar says it's a positive step and it's necessary to reform the Sudanese economy. Unifying the exchange price, it shall lead to stabilizing the exchange rate and encourage the investors to invest in Sudan. Investments shall create movement in the Sudanese resources that need big capital for production and open doors for Sudan to get involved in the international economy by utilizing its natural resources. Sudan's foreign debt reached $70 billion in 2020, and the budget deficit exceeded $1.5 billion. The inflation rate recently surpassed 300%, and the Sudanese pound has steadily lost value against foreign currencies. Some economists, like Walid al-Noor, think the step to devalue the pound is risky and will have a severe negative impact on people and the economy. He says the devaluation will be massive if the central bank doesn't have enough cash savings of the hard currency. He added that the greatest impact will be on the middle class and the people with low income. But analyst Abu Bakr Muhammad says the effects on average people will be small, as the official economy was not controlled by the market. He says he doesn't think the negative impact will be big, as the economy was not built on the official economy. All of the markets dealing prices, especially the imports and exports and imported life necessities, were evaluated with the black market rate. Now the official sector and institutions will be rid of the political and administrative restrictions that force them to set unreal prices on the market. Late last year, the U.S. removed Sudan from its state sponsors of terrorism list, paving the way for the country to get financial help from the World Bank and International Monetary Fund. A delegation of the World Bank recently visited Sudan and agreed to begin a loan relief program in March if Sudan made economical and structural reforms. Naba Mohideen for VOA News, Khartoum.
Tanzania's President John Magufuli appears to be acknowledging the problem of COVID-19 in his country after months of claiming that the virus had been defeated through prayers and steam treatments. While not specifically naming the virus, Magufuli on Sunday urged Tanzanians to begin wearing face masks for what he calls respiratory illnesses that are becoming a problem. Charles Kumbe reports from Dar es Salaam.
It is almost a year since Tanzania President John Magufuli declared his country to be free from COVID-19 and said prayer helped to defeat the virus. But on Sunday church mass in the capital Dodoma, Magufuli urged citizens to take precautions, including traditional remedies and wear face masks, but only locally made ones.
Sisi tuchukue tahadhari za kiafya.
We should take health precautions as it was announced, Magufuli says. He said we should put God first while searching for an alternative in line with steam inhalation. He said that his own children got sick, some of his little ones got sick, and they recovered. It's all about putting God first, he said, adding that steam inhalation should not be ignored. At the end of last week, Magufuli called on Tanzanians for 3 days of prayer to defeat unnamed respiratory diseases amid warning from the Catholic Church, the U.S. Embassy, and others that Tanzania has seen a deadly resurgence in coronavirus infections. Tanzanians such as Baraka Kila found President's remarks unsettling. Kila says at first they were convinced that it really did not exist. But looking at social networks like Twitter and Facebook, Various people were posting about death caused by a coronavirus, and it was causing a lot of controversies, and the government disagreed. To a large extent, he says, we must continue to believe that some of the death that occurred were caused by COVID-19. We are scared because when the president admits the existence of coronavirus, it means it has spread a lot as killer. Rachel Nzengo, a student at the University of Dar es Salaam, says the move will awaken those who are not taking the virus seriously in Tanzania. After the president spoke, she thinks Tanzanians will start to protect themselves. She says that people have been squeezing into community buses without taking precautions. Nzengo adds that she thinks it's a good thing that yesterday Magufuli talked. People will start to protect themselves because we see people dying every day, and they say that there's no disease. Magufuli spoke after the death of the vice president of Zanzibar region, Saif Sharif Hamad. Hamad's death drew widespread attention after his party said he had died of COVID-19. Tanzania has refused to track coronavirus cases, so there are no figures on how many people have fallen ill or died from the virus. However, other East African countries have experienced thousands of cases, and there's no reason to think Tanzania has been spared. The president's speech may change people's perceptions and prompt doubters of COVID-19 to take serious precautions for the first time. Charles Kombe for VOA News, Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
Teachers in Malawi public schools are staging a sit-in strike, refusing to go back to work until the government agrees to pay them bonuses for risking COVID-19. Malawi's government last week announced the reopening of schools yesterday, Monday, after a 5-week suspension over a surge in COVID-19 cases. The teachers say working during the pandemic puts them at risk, while authorities say adequate precautions are being taken. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi's schools were due to reopen this week after a 5-week suspension caused by a surge in COVID-19 cases. Teachers reported to work Monday but refused to begin classes until the government meets their demands for high-risk pay and better protective equipment. In response, students at some schools in central Malawi held street protests against the teachers' strike. Misozi Jumbe is a secondary school learner in Dowa district. She says the teachers' strike is ill-timed.
The strike is not helping. Why were the teachers not doing the strike when we closed the school? We opened the start strike. We want to learn, and I am supposed to sit for my MSCE exams, and I'm not happy at all.
Malawi first closed the schools in March last year, well before it confirmed its first 3 cases of COVID-19 during the first wave of the pandemic. It reopened the schools in September. The classes were suspended again for 5 weeks in January this year because of a surge in COVID-19 that saw some teachers and learners infected. However, the striking teachers say working during the pandemic puts them at risk. Wile Malimba is president of Teachers Union of Malawi. He says personal protective equipment like face coverings, sanitizers, and soap for hand washing are inadequate in many schools.
Of course, we have seen some schools receive the soap from the government, but for sanitizer, not yet. So looking at all these situations, we are saying no, the government is not ready to reopen schools.
Government authorities previously argued adequate precautions were being taken. Announcing reopening of schools during a televised address last Wednesday, Education Minister Agnes Nyalonje said the government has allocated about $6 million to the school's reopening program.
My ministry has made money available directly to schools through zonal accounts for them to procure soaps, to procure masks, to procure buckets where buckets need replacing, to make sure that when schools open, these things are in place.
Malimba said Monday he could not tell when the teachers will resume work. However, he said a meeting between government authorities and teachers' representatives was underway in the capital, Lilongwe, to find the best solution to the teachers' strike. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
And that's it for this Tuesday, February 23rd edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.